You know, I thought about this time and time again about, you know, how this thing was going to play out. And, you know, is the love for me still here in Minnesota? And, you know, all I've been seeing is nothing but positive. So, you know, to all the Viking fans and, you know, just coming to that Metrodome, pull your 84 jerseys out, man. I think this is going to be a fun ride.
TCL is a proud sponsor of the Score North Studios. TCL, America's fastest growing TV brand. It's Minnesota Sports Rewind.
Welcome to another episode of Minnesota Sports Rewind, where we do deep dives into prominent Minnesota sports events, games, trades, moments, you name it. My name is Phil Mackey, and this episode is all about the 2010 Minnesota Vikings, the return of Randy Moss, and all of the things that came afterward. One of the craziest cluster bleep seasons in Minnesota sports history. Not just Viking season, but Minnesota sports history. And our crew for this episode is Judd Zolgad, my co-host on Mackey and Judd with Rami, who covered the Vikings that season for the Star Tribune. And that was such a load that you decided to leave the beat writing business altogether and join us on the radio side of the fence.
It's not exactly inaccurate, by the way. That was when the roof came down, which we'll talk about. That was the day I got it, that the wife came to pick me up downtown, and I said, it's now too much.
I've seen too much. I've done too much. And NFL Network's Tom Pelissero also joining us on this episode, who at the time covered the Vikings for 1500ESPN.com. And I believe, Tom, I don't remember when in 2010, but I remember Judd and I at a bar. I think it might have been on our trip to New York when we were covering the Twins Yankees, and then you stayed for Jets Vikings. Randy Mott, was that his debut with the Vikings?
That was his debut with the Vikings. There was a lot going on.
Yeah.
And that was only the fourth game of the year.
And I remember Judd leaned over at the bar and he's like, if you guys got any openings over there, I'm ready to be done with this.
I remember being at a different bar with Judd after that season. It had to have been March, April, May, somewhere in there. And we were over at Brits on the rooftop when you were thinking of making the move over.
Oh, yeah. That was the year that basically did me in. There was no question about it. In fact, the only time in my life, and by the way, regional books do not sell. I'll say that. Pelissero and I actually talked long and hard about, should we do a book on this season called And Then the Roof Collapsed?
Yeah.
And it was the only time in my life, honest to God, that I've ever thought a book might be a good idea.
Is that the new working title of this episode, by the way? Can we steal that?
And hopefully then the roof not. Collapsed? We've had a few water issues down here, so I...
But sure, that was the only time that I've ever talked to anybody about doing a book, and we actually did talk about
and
it.
And I did actually pitch it to someone and was told too episodic. So.
How many chapters? This is a good segue, because how many chapters would that book
Oh, have somewhere had? I have it. I have the entire plan for the book. I have the pitch and everything. I don't remember how many chapters we had
planned.
Well,
if you were to do it, it would start the previous, in 2010, in January, in a Superdome. I mean, it would start there at the end of what became the 2009, a great year that turned into an epic game. But in all seriousness, it was the perfect book, I thought. Because you went from 2010 in a locker room full of people who basically knew that they had spent every last bit of sweat that they had. And Brett Favre, I mean, great story, right? And then we show up in Mankato, all hell breaks loose. It was, if you were ever going to do a sports book, that was it.
Yeah, as long as you don't like happy endings.
Happy endings are boring.
Judd's never been.
We'll take that out of context later. Happy you endings. Can replay that on Mackie and Judd with Rami ad nauseum. Happy endings are boring, said Judd.
So to set the seed for the 2010 Vikings, I want to set the scene and then go through. I don't know if I nailed everything here, but I have a summary of events, everything from sort of the end of the 2009 championship game that Judd talks about. But the Vikings were coming off a four-year crescendo that culminated in a trip to the aforementioned NFC title game. Favre was physically decimated in that game. He underwent arthroscopic ankle surgery. We all saw the photos that came out of his battered and bruised legs and ankle. And so the Vikings essentially spent the entire offseason trying to figure out, is this championship window still open? Is Brett Favre coming back? Is it time to transition into a rebuild? Who would the starting quarterback be? And I found a snippet from Judd's Star Tribune article after Favre's arrival. So they convince him to come back, and we're going to get into all this stuff. But And this is what you wrote, Judd, all right? Favre, who wavered on his decision on seemingly a daily basis and even told the Vikings he was going to stay retired on August 2nd, will turn 41 years old in October. He took a beating in the NFC Championship game, came away with an injured left ankle, had arthroscopic surgery for the third time in his career, and as Dr. James Andrews removed scar tissue and bone spurs, was quoted as saying, "It went fine. He's rehabbing and trying to decide what he's going to do." Favre, though, wasn't happy with how the ankle responded. He visited Andrews last week in Gulf Breeze. This is now just after training camp. This is like August during training camp. To have the ankle examined again. Favre's decision to return comes as a surprise to no one, but the question now is what type of compensation will he get for playing? He was originally thought to make $13 million, but there have been talks that now they're going to have to tweak it up to $16 million with $4 million in bonuses. So essentially, we know you're too banged up to play. You don't really want to come back. Can we throw like $4 or $5 million at you to please come back, was the mindset going into training camp. And then this list of events took place between Favre being pried out of his home in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and the end of the year. Favre comes back. Sidney Rice needed knee surgery, but was also trying to leverage a new contract.
Which, by the way, to be clear, they were not transparent with Favre about.
It was hip.
Yeah, it
was a hip surgery.
And he had been hurt. He was hurt coming out of the Saints game. And he needed surgery, and he knew that. And the Vikings basically said, "You need the surgery." And he said, "If I don't get a new contract, I'm not having the surgery." But meanwhile, nobody is transparent with Favre about Rice's status. And keep in mind, 2009, Favre made Sidney Rice. But when Favre made you, he was like an artist. So now this was his painting, and the painting was going to be taken away, unbeknownst to the guy being pried out of retirement.
Percy Harvin also had migraine issues or other issues. And I think his grandma died.
His grandma died.
Camp.
It was supposedly grandma, and allegedly, I'll say it to be nice. Grandma died when he was in Mankato. He disappeared. He left. Brad was basically calling him on a daily basis, "When are you coming back?" He never came back to Mankato, right, Tommy?
Correct.
And then he came, and then eventually resurfaced at Winter Park.
And a day or two later was taken off the practice field in an ambulance.
Yeah.
Yeah, he collapsed. He actually, he came out for practice. He wasn't practicing. He came out to watch practice. Doubled over, vomited, collapsed in his vomit, and was on the field. Nobody was called for a long time. The trainers attended to him. I was told way after the fact his heart actually stopped for a second, and that's when they called the ambulance and took him away. I'm not kidding.
And this is all, this was before the season, right?
This is the Mankato portion of
yeah.
them still in what I guess would be considered training camp mode.
So when we right? when we right. get when we get to the season,
yes, back in Eden Prairie by the time Percy collapsed.
Correct.
Yes. Yeah. So this is all stuff. This is before the season even starts. That you could see things brewing, and
there were other things before the season, but those are the high notes. Yes.
Well, what else? Tell us. What do you remember besides that? I mean,
there was the Toby Gerhardt holdout. Toby Gerhardt held out second round pick.
Yeah.
Now remember, they had 2 second round picks there. They had Chris Cook and they had Toby Gerhardt.
Yep.
Chris was there on time. Toby, I don't even remember exactly what the issue was. It was something, that was pre the current collective bargaining agreements. You could negotiate a little more with rookie contracts. He held out for a couple of days. He comes back on like the third day of camp. They're in pads and just got his ass kicked. All right, the white running back from Stanford who held out for 2 days. The moment he walked on the field, and you could just hear guys chirping at him about, welcome here. One point, Pat Williams, at that point was, 350, 360 pounds.
So listen to 315, okay?
Of which, he was 315 from the waist up. He had these little tiny dancer legs.
He's a great leg.
He had great. He was like clearly an athlete.
Yeah, he was ballerina.
From the waist down, and then he just was massive on the top. At one point, he just flattens Toby Gerhardt right in a practice. Like everybody was knocking him around, but Pat just roasted him at one point. And how are we feeling on swearing on these podcasts? Are we okay on it? Are we trying to avoid that?
This will eventually be on the radio. So don't get us fined by the FCC.
Don't do what
I can't do. I can't do a Pat Williams impression then because it was like every third word was this guy coming in.
Yeah, he used four letter like words over as and transition.
We were interviewing him after, but basically he was just talking smack about his teammate and just like, basically you don't walk in here 2 days late and just come out here like you're going to, this is what's going to happen to you. So there's all that going on. You had Sydney, running sprints.
Didn't Ray take him out too?
I mean, Ray didn't need an excuse to take
him out. Because Ray was going to take you out no matter what. I thought Ray took him out too.
Ray Edwards. Did you go to the boxing match?
Oh yeah, we went. I went.
It was during the lockout.
We went together.
Yeah. To
thanks for remembering.
Grand Casino Hinckley. Was that where it was?
We went up to Duluth. That off.
No, I think it was Hinckley. We went all the way to Duluth. That'd
or towards
Hinckley.
Duluth. It was
Grand Casino Hinckley.
Yeah, it was Hinckley. Yeah.
This was the following.
Yes,
year,
we went together.
Ray had decided during the lockout he was going to become a boxer. And Ray, like if you saw him, like I mean, he was a big dude, like just built. I don't know what he was listed at, but he had to have been. 6'5" and 260, like no body fat, or 290 probably, like big guy, defensive end. And so I believe it was his first fight, maybe his second. I think it was his first fight.
They brought in a tomato can for him.
And they brought in like a guy who's built like you, Phil. It was like a 5'7" pudgy white guy,
but ruggedly handsome and charming.
No, he was way fatter than you.
You or Seifert or somebody described it as like a Three Stooges routine. Basically, Ray could like put his hand on the guy's head while the guy's swinging at him and can't actually get at him. Like that was the guy, and then may or may not have taken a dive, which later there's a famous video of Ray in another fight where the guy literally takes a dive, like swinging a miss, and the guy's just like, oh, just goes down. It was just a clown show. But they had this group of personalities on that team that, you got where they thought. We've got a chance if we can get Favre back. Because you had, obviously you had Sydney, who was coming off a good year. At that point, seemed like he might play because every day he's just running wind sprints on the side field with Shug, just running back and forth.
Yep.
Like you'd watch him. Everybody wrote a note on it every day. Sydney's out there again. He's running.
You also weren't sure at that point if Sydney Rice, because he was a second round pick too, you weren't sure if he was a legitimate top echelon wide receiver with or without Favre, and there was that feeling out process in the next few years of was he hurt, was he not legitimate, did Favre make him, was it a combination?
Yeah, and Sydney he had injury issues constantly. I mean that was his biggest thing. That's what had hurt him up until 2009 was the only year he was healthy in his entire career.
But it turned out that he had basically come out of that Saints game and they said you need surgery, and he said I'll get surgery when you give me an extension. They said we're not doing that, and so nobody really communicated after that. And so we get to training camp, and I think it was the first day of camp, and Rice isn't, they're talking about here. Because, they always tell you so-and-so is going to start on the pup. There's always a guy or two on the pup. And so the physically unable to perform list, Brad starts going through it. He's like, Sydney Rice. And we're all like, well, what? And we're thinking, okay, it's some minor thing, minor setback. And to your point, Tom, as camp went along, it became very clear that this guy was hurt. And now the problem is, eventually, as you're going to get to, they go get Favre out of Mississippi, and nobody really tells Brett, by the way, the guy you really liked is hurt. And then the other problem was that is the year that the Vikings, to replace Sidney Rice, worked out the trade with the Chargers for Vincent Jackson.
Yes.
And they had that all set up and set to go, and A.J. Smith, right, the GM of the Chargers, at the last second tells Rick, bleep Vincent Jackson, I'm going to squat on his rights. And so now you're left with nobody, and Brett shows up finally. Hey, I'm the hero. I'm back with no wide receiver.
So that's the next notch on the timeline. So the Vikings started 0-2 in that 2010 season. They lose the rematch to New Orleans. Okay, dust yourself off. It happens. But then they lose to a mediocre Miami team the next week, and that's when red flags start popping up. Somewhere in that first month is when the Vincent Jackson trade got vetoed, and then they pivoted over, and Bill Belichick makes Randy Moss available. So the Vikings, in the first month of the season, have now traded, was it a third-round pick, I believe?
Yeah. And to be clear,
Randy
too,
Moss.
Well, hold on. How fast are we going through this? Because there's a whole receiver timeline. There are a ton of things that happen.
Let's do this. Let's fly through the timeline, and then let's circle back on these key questions.
Because there's a key Vincent Jackson-Rice thing here that transpires.
So Moss comes to the Vikings, and then within a couple weeks, he also then
27 days, was that what it was? It was about there.
Yeah, 27.
It was under a month.
28 of the longest days of my life.
Decides he wouldn't feed Tanucci's Italian restaurant food to his dog.
Which, by the way, we also have to get to, because that's one of the most misunderstood stories and one of the most BS stories ever put down in this town.
Brad Childress gets fired. Metrodome roof collapses. Giants game moved to Detroit. Philly game played on a Tuesday. Vikings played games at TCF Bank Stadium without heating coils. Brett Favre unconscious on the frozen tundra
Punter
of TCF
warned
Bank Stadium.
Of that.
Chris Cluey foreshadowing, beware the Ides of March.
The Vikings whipped the punter, and then it turns out to be right.
Leslie Frazier gets the full-time job. And then after all of this happens, the Vikings decide to hit the reset button and then draft Christian Ponder in 2011 and then go into the Christian Ponder era. So here's my first key question. Why ultimately, let's start here and then we'll explore all the landscape. Why did Brett Favre come back?
You want to take this one?
Well, you said you had Steve Hutchinson explain the story, and I know Hutch's version, and I know the version of the people involved, in essence. So all right, here's what you have to understand. So the first time when Favre joins the Vikings, 2009, never shows up in Mankato, right? They get back to Winter Park. Everybody knew that's probably when it would happen. And sure enough, first day back after training camp, they're back in Eden Prairie, Favre comes. So the second year, everybody kind of thinks this is what's going to happen. Like, we all did the song and dance every day of talking to Tavares Jackson and Sage Rosenfels as if they're going to be the quarterback, when everybody, including our buddy Sage, knew that was probably not going to happen. Like, I remember me and Judd, and there might have been one other person there, like a week before the end of camp that year, 2 weeks before the end of camp, talking with Sage about, like, asking him about, you know, possibilities, where is he going to end up? And it was those conversations where Sage is just kind of playing along with the questions, you know, like, I'm just here to, you know, maximize the reps. And then as soon as I was like, all right, guys, shut the recorders, like, so where am I getting traded? You know, like, it's one of those, like, all right, we all know what's going on here, right? So 2 weeks or so before Favre actually comes back, right, it was about a week into camp.
Yep.
And the story breaks that Favre is not coming, which I think was you.
And that was.
That broke that.
And at that time, so to be clear.
First week of August it was.
Right, but 2009 was all, he did call Brad and say, I'm not coming back. But that was to avoid training camp.
Right.
And in 2009, it was all a charade.
But point being, on the outside, we all looked at it as, but 2010, well, this is going to play out the same way.
But well, that was the hubris of the Vikings to think that. In retrospect, now, having been told stories about that well after the fact, and in Brett's defense on this one, by 2010, he wanted to beat the Packers, and he did twice. And so the 2010 thing was way more legit than we thought at that time, that he really wasn't going to come back.
So he says he's not coming back. And that was after Brad had called him. So the way that I've understood the story was, by the time they make this mission down to Hattiesburg, which is about the third week of August, right? And I don't know for certain whether Brad said this or everybody knew. But basically, Brad told Hutch and Longwell, you guys need to go and get Favre. And the message, whether it was spoken or unspoken, was, because he won't come back if I go.
Now, what I've also heard was there was a point where Brad's like, I'm going, and they told him, no.
Right.
We'll go. And they took Jared as an aside because they knew that Brett liked him. But
bring the fun guy with the mullet.
I remember.
It always works.
Since it's well past the fact, I remember one night when it was all sort of percolating, because you always knew there was a chance Brett was going to come back. And I remember one night driving, I texted Longwell, who, you know, and I said, what's going on? He said, you can't tell anybody, but we are probably going down there. And he's like, this is the only way.
It's always good when you tell a journalist, by the way, you can't tell anyone this huge story.
And in 2010, I didn't. No, but he's like, it can't come from me. And I'm like, that's fine. But the fact was, this had become very convoluted. And by now, to what Tom's talking about, now there is a concern he ain't coming back.
Right.
And
this was the last ditch.
Yes.
We got to do it. So they go into the house. And Favre was just kind of like, "What? Like, why are you guys here? Like, I'm not playing." And over
you got to do the voice if you're going to do the Favre.
Am I going to play?
I
probably not.
Why you guys
over the course of however many hours, they talk him into coming back. Like, he was truly done. He did not want to play. Now, to Brett's credit, when he got there, like, he tried to flip the switch. I truly believe that, seeing how he operated, the attitude and everything. Like, he thought, perhaps wrongly, but he really thought, I've still got this. The problem was, I believe it was 2 days later, that Sidney opts to have surgery.
Right, which I don't think he was ever, I'm sure he was not told about. He did not, Brett's Brett. He doesn't follow football. He didn't know. He was very loose on details.
He's not watching Total Access every night.
Yeah, he doesn't watch Pelissero's show. No, I'm serious. So to what you're just saying, you're right. So he gets there, and he's like, okay, we could still do this. Where's 18? And 18's not there.
So then, and now this goes to the wide receiver timeline if we want to zip through this quickly.
Hold on. Let's get to the wide receiver timeline in a second. After we
I'm
hear,
really excited about this.
After we hear,
I've sat on this for weeks.
Steve Hutchinson's version of this story.
Were you guys? You were on the plane ride going down there to pull him back in 2010, right?
I was.
Yeah. What was
the,
that?
The stealth covert mission.
You were doing specialty work in the practice shed, according to your special teams coordinator Brian Murphy at the time, Hutch.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one thing. I never did go back, and I mean, is there? Were there cameras there for that, or was it just kind of just audio on those post-practice press conferences?
I think there were cameras for that, if I'm not mistaken.
I got to look back and see them at some point, because it was just like, apparently Childress didn't prep them at all.
Correct.
On, like, what to say, so they were just literally grasping at straw. I mean, it was like, yeah, we were,
yes,
we were repaving 169 or something. I mean, it was like, they could have come up with something better than that. But it's funny, like, we went down there and spent the night, and it was some big covert deal. Childress kind of called me in his office after practice and said, hey, what do you think, you and I fly down and go get Brett? And I said, I got a better idea. How about you stay here and send, like, Jared, because Jared makes him laugh, and Ryan Longwell, because he loves Ryan, they've had such a pass together, and then I'll go too, and we'll three of us. You go, okay. So we go down there, and the pilot had a, flight plan going into New Orleans that we were going to change mid-flight so that anybody following Ziggy's tail number wouldn't see it flew to Hattiesburg. And, it was this big thing. And it worked. We got down there, and when it started, I guess about the time you guys were figuring out we weren't at practice, that's kind of when we were in the car ride back to the plane to get into the plane to fly back to Minneapolis. And by the time, obviously, there was the helicopter and the whole the charade there, but it was pretty fun. It was funny. We were laughing the whole time. it was fun. We got him back.
Yeah, you did.
But we basically kidnapped
him. You put a ski mask over his head.
And Steve, I didn't buy this at the time, but I have since been told that he really, really had reservations and/or didn't want to come back. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah.
For 2010?
Yeah, he was, I think he knew at that point, he would have been fine saying, no, I'm done. And then, and for whatever reason, maybe he just knew or whatever, but, we were, at that point too, Jared and Ryan and I were like, because we get there and we kind of – now, of course, his whole family knew we were coming. He was the only one who didn't know. So we get there at like – I don't know, it was like 9:30, 10 o'clock at night by the time we get to his house, and it was like this big surprise thing. And I'm not kidding when I say – he was like, oh, so great to see you guys. 15 minutes later, where's Brett? He went to bed. Seriously, we're sitting in, on the couch, and Deanna's like, I think he went to bed. And we're like, oh, this is going to be tough. Like, we thought we were going to walk in, and he was going to be like, oh, yeah, let's go. Let's go, win one for the Gipper. And no. So the next day it was that we were talking, and we started thinking, well, if he doesn't come back, people are going to start finding out we were down here regardless. And then what does it look like, for the organization and the confidence we have in the other quarterback? I mean, it was just going to be a media circus that way. So I don't know. I mean, yeah, like you see, it was, that's true. I mean, he did not want to come back at first, and then finally, and then when he did, he was typical Brett fashion, just like, all right, let's go. Yeah. I mean, like, But you just talk the kid into, like, you know, throwing rocks off a bridge or something.
I mean, nobody could have predicted anything that happened that season, too. Like, think about all of the things from Randy Moss, coach fired, dome collapses, TCF Bank Stadium.
A Sunday night game on Tuesday in Philly.
Yeah.
A home game that was supposed to be a Sunday game turned into Monday night, a home game in Detroit against the Giants. I mean, you couldn't. I don't know if there was a circus season. I mean, every team has their little secrets and what's done behind closed doors. But I mean, I don't know if you're going to find it more of a circus than that year for us.
Hey, Hutch, it's a forgotten part, but that was the same year. And ordinarily, this would have been a huge story. That's the same year that that Percy had the migraines. He came back on the practice field in Eden Prairie and threw up and collapsed, and they had to bring an ambulance to get him. And that was a small part with all the things that went on that year. That became a very small addendum to that season.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, and that... And then you mentioned Randy, and then Randy's like press conference after whatever his last, I can't remember if his last, what his last game was with us, but
New England.
He just kind of ripped, you know, the Childress and you know, basically talked about how he wanted to be back on Patriots team. Like it was like just if you could imagine it happened.
All right, before we get into key question number two, any final thoughts on just the Brett Favre timeline and him coming back in 2010.
One thing with Favre is when he came there after camp, and despite the song and dance things, in 2009, that guy walked into Eden Prairie, Winter Park at the time, bound and determined to shove it up everybody's you-know-what, and that included the Packers especially, I always thought. And that game at Lambeau was unbelievable. I've never felt a stadium naturally shake like that. It felt like he was going to take off. And they hated him, and by that time he couldn't stand Ted Thompson and the Packers and McCarthy. But what was so – the juxtaposition that interested me so much in 2010 when he came back was he literally, Tom, was dragged back. Like he literally, you know, Longwell and Allen and Hutch, he came back for them. And and the story that I was told, as, you know, Steve talked about, was they sat on that couch and said, "Don't worry about Brad, come back for us." And he did it. But the guy that walked into Winter Park that day in 2010 was a very different guy. He sort of came back as a sympathetic, okay, if you need my help, I'll help you.
And $1 million a game doesn't.
Well, sure. But the guy that came back in 2009 was on a mission. And I can't tell you, Tom, if you recall that, the difference between those two personalities.
Well, and I had been there for Favre's final year in Green Bay, and I was on the Packers beat in 07, 08, 09. So I saw all sides of it. I spent a lot of time in Minneapolis in 09 because that was the biggest story in Green Bay, too, was Favre playing for the Vikings. All I know was you saw Favre wanting to do it in 2010. That's what I mean by he tried to flip the switch. But from the start, you just felt like it was different. You know, it's one thing of, you know, what he's saying at the podium, because I was at both introductory press conferences too. I think it was different though when you just saw what was happening on the field, and that really all started with the opener where the Vikings couldn't generate, you know, a whole lot of offense. And then the week two game is the one that stands out to me because that was against the Dolphins at home. And by the end of that game, you knew this is going straight to hell. Because Favre repeatedly in the red zone was throwing back shoulder fades, which was the Sidney Rice specialty, right? Just go to the pylon, throw it up there, go get it. And he was throwing it to the guys they had then, basically being like, I can't do this.
Right.
We don't have the players to do this. They lost that game at home. And even though they beat the Lions the next week before the bye, you just felt like this team is going to go anywhere. They have to get a receiver. And they had been trying already, but then that led to a move that, I won't say it defined 2010, but it certainly was a memorable month in Vikings history.
So key question number two, when Randy Moss came back, what did you guys think in that moment what did you guys think was going to happen? Revenge Tour? If you had to put all your, like, in that moment, if you had to put all your chips on either Revenge Tour and Vikings bounce back or complete total disaster, which is what happened.
Yep.
I would have put my chips on Revenge Tour, not thinking deep enough about, well, if Bill Belichick in the middle of a season is cutting bait on someone, I would have thought Brett Favre, Randy Moss, they're going to get this thing together and we're going to see something magical and historic.
So,
well, we did see something historic, I guess.
I know you guys are going to be shocked by this, but when that, when the news broke that that was coming down, I think it was a off day. I think it was a Tuesday. And I was out at a bar. And somebody tells me they're going to get Moss. I'm like, what?
It happened on a day where the Twins were hosting the Yankees in a playoff game, I believe, at Target Field.
Anyway, so the news comes down. They get Moss from the Patriots, which, of course, fans are ecstatic about because they love Randy Moss, and he's coming back. Honestly, that, to me, is the day that it crossed over from, is this going to be a circus, to this is a circus. And it, when it crossed over, in my mind, was the introductory press conference for Moss. And I'm not joking. This is going to sound, this might sound silly, but when I knew that we were in for a gong show, was Moss is in this press conference, and it's Moss at his best. And Randy Moss, a very smart guy. I mean, like, he could be a bleep hole, yeah, but he was a very smart guy.
Yeah.
And I remember there was a person, I want to say a woman from NFL Network. She's trying to ask a question about Moss's, what happened with the Patriots or something. And he's like, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. And he cuts her off, and he's like, next question. And it was like an auction. So I'm like, this is really weird. Ziggy Wolf is in the back of the press conference, and this is when press conferences were held in the shed at Winter Park at the side of the practice field. So very just odd.
It's not a shed, but...
Well, it was a practice shed. It's a shed.
Shed. It's it
was
a shed. It's a very large shed.
It was a big,
it's a field house.
It's a big shed.
It's the field house.
Now, punts hit the ceiling, you guys. It was a joke. Anyway, so when I knew this was a when I knew this was off the rails, though, was... So Randy's literally whipping through the press conference, whipping question, question, question. And the last thing he says is, y'all lucky I wasn't on that boat because there would have been worse or something. And he walks out. And Ziggy, I look back at Ziggy and he's laughing. Now, I've never told this story before, but when that whole boat thing happened in 05, which was my first year on the beat at the Star Tribune with Seifert.
Year after, or the same year, Moss got traded.
Correct. There was a moment when something happened. It was with the whole tight. The boat thing, I think it was. And I'm not kidding you guys. There was a moment where somebody told me they saw Ziggy so upset about the boat thing that he took a picture of Moss off the wall and threw it down. Like, he was livid. How could this happen? I'm going to run. And, you know, he has run a respectable organization here, a franchise that people will be proud of because he's a Giants fan. And as big a dumpster fire as the Giants are right now, you know, the Giants have a lot of pride, heritage. And so when Moss says this at that press conference 5 years after the fact, and Ziggy's laughing, oh, that's funny you said that about the boat. I'm thinking to myself, that's not funny at all. That's, he's basically warning you of what's coming to town. And that's when it crossed over to me to be, this is now going to become a gong show. And I didn't know how, and I would never have predicted what happened, but I went from being like, everything seems weird to, oh no, this isn't good.
So I was on the beat, so to speak, with the Vikings in 03-04. So Moss's final two seasons before he got traded to the Raiders. And when he came back, from that press conference through the caterer thing, through every, you know, the press conference that he did after the Patriots game, which I'm sure we'll talk more in depth about because it's one of the highlights of Judd's life.
Oh, there are not many, so it's good.
The way that I described it at the time was, this is like the frat brother who graduated 6 years ago, who was like the alpha male in the frat and now is like coming back to party. And it's just like over the top because Moss in 03-04, he ran that locker room. He had other guys like Kelly Campbell was kind of his right-hand man. But like it was Moss. He was loud. He was a big personality. Everybody answered to him. And that's the dynamic that they were trying to change when they traded him to the Raiders. They thought that just the leadership needed to change because he was the one, you know, that was – you know, everybody looked to for leadership, and Moss is so much smarter than everybody else. He's such a better player than everyone else. People couldn't get away with the stuff that Moss got away with because they're not as good as him or as smart as him. So when he came back, it was just like, here I am. Here we go. And it just was this fundamental shift in the locker room because nobody knew how to handle it. He was still the loudest guy in the room, but nobody played with him. It had been 6 years. And nobody knew the guy.
And to your point, the main pledge was Percy Harvin, which was a disaster because Percy was already teetering on, I don't think this guy can coach. And when he looked at Randy, and I think Randy backed up Percy and said, kid, you're good. Brad can't coach. And all hell broke loose then.
With all the stuff that was
already, because of that.
All the stuff that was already going on with Percy that season. And he was on the team. Moss was on the team. And again, I might be wrong on the number. I believe it was 27 days. Moss was living in a hotel in Edina during those 27 days because he obviously didn't have a house there or anything. When he got cut, there was one guy there helping him move out, and it was Percy Harvin.
Yeah.
They instantly forged that connection. And I always thought that Percy was an interesting, engaging guy. I infamously gave him the Corey Stringer Good Guy Award. Was the presenting person for that once.
Yeah, congratulations. Nice work.
But that, I mean, that was, you know, there were some dark moments there for Percy. And then it was after Moss got cut, of course, that there was an altercation that Judd and I have discussed before involving Percy and Brad.
Yeah.
That was on the way to, was that the Friday before the Cardinals game, I believe?
Yes.
So a couple weeks after, the week after Moss got cut, days after Moss got cut.
Yeah,
and Judd knows the story better than I do.
And things have been, so to backtrack just a little bit to training camp, when Percy's grandma, quote-unquote, died, I mean, I think she died, I have no idea, Brad started to call him on a daily basis. And the reason why he didn't come back was he flipped out. Because Brad, and so he claimed migraines, which might have been true, I don't know. But Childress supposedly started to call him every day. Are you coming back today? Are you coming back today? And he went nuts. And then, so they get Randy, and Randy and Percy, I'm not sure what you thought of Percy, Tom. He always struck me as a pretty savvy football player. He might have been a very dumb guy. I have no idea if he could pass
the
test.
When you got him talking football, though, like he knew the game.
Randy is one of the smartest football players. As weird as Randy is, one of the smartest football players ever. Randy would, during open locker room, for the media, when most guys will go eat, everyone disappears, Randy would sit at his locker. And I remember walking in one day, and he had one of those sort of pencil sets in a plastic bag with plays written down on a play card, like a red pencil, a green pencil. And I remember walking into the Winter Park locker room, and he's sitting there with his cards. And he won't talk to the media, which is fine, but he's going through these plays like a coach would. And so it sort of popped with you, wow, this guy is incredibly football savvy, intelligent. And so, long story short, what I was told after the fact as well is that Brett, Randy, and maybe Percy, but Brett and Randy would sit at the front of the offensive meeting room and make fun of what the coaches were saying, especially Childress.
Okay, here's a question for you guys. Because everyone puts the Randy Moss at the center of why this thing went off the rails and the locker room went awry and then Brad Childress eventually got fired. How much was Brett Favre, not to blame him, by the way, Brett Favre had a magical 2009 season, but obviously did not connect with Brad Childress and vice versa. How much was Brett Favre also to blame for Brad Childress getting fired halfway through that season? In terms of, this guy's a clown show, don't listen to him, well, mocking Brad Childress, etc.
Just quickly to go back to that question off of Randy, I was told that Spielman definitely went to Brad when the Vincent Jackson thing fell through. And he had a chance to get Randy Moss from Belichick. And Rick said to Brad, can you handle him? And Brad said, absolutely, I can. And Brad was 1,000% wrong. So, yes, Brad is probably ultimately, I wouldn't say to blame, but he can shoulder some of the blame. But when a coach tells you, I can handle Randy Moss, which if Brad was being honest, he would have said, no, that ain't going to work.
Well, and Brad told me years later, his biggest regret in his entire time in Minnesota was not telling the Wilfs he was cutting Randy.
Well, and that's another great story.
They cut him without telling ownership less than a month after making a season-defining, franchise-defining type of move.
And the owner laughing about the boat.
Brad famously described it as a programmatic non-fit in the press conference after.
Can we talk about that press conference? That's one of my favorite press conferences. That next to the Randy press conference in New England the day before, that Monday press conference was one of the most outstanding press conferences ever.
Let me just run through the receiver timeline real quick, just to why this all transpired, because this is months in the making. It's Sidney not having the surgery. August 10th, they sign a guy named Freddie Brown. Thinking bringing in just another body, trying to get somebody else in the mix. That doesn't work out. August 24th, which is right after you realize Sidney's going to have surgery, they signed Javon Walker.
That's right.
The former Packer.
Who was Sidney Rice too far before Sidney Rice.
Correct.
Because I covered the year that he made Javon Walker.
Right.
Same problems, too. Injured all the time.
So that didn't work. 2 days later, they trade Benny Sapp for Greg Camarillo. Little slot receiver from Miami, who was a fine player, but just not at all comparable to what Rice is.
And Benny Sapp had been a pretty instrumental part of the nickel in 2009.
5 days later, Rice goes on reserve pup. Then the Vincent Jackson trade falls through late September. Mm-hmm. And then October 7th is the Moss trade. So they were constantly trying to fill that void. Moss makes his debut against the Jets. Very first play is a wide receiver pass with Moss that is an illegal formation because he completes it to Favre, who is not aligned in a position where he could catch it. That kind of set the stage for everything.
In a game that was delayed by lightning, if you remember.
For like an hour and a half.
Yeah. We
in
sat
a week
there
where it was the I don't know how I can best describe this, and something will be air on the radio, but pictures, allegedly, of Favre and little Favre had emerged.
I forgot about, that's a whole other, and that's another topic.
That's all going on that week. The tabloid writers from New York are in Minnesota to ask Favre about it.
Deadspin held on to the pictures. Right. Deadspin broke the story, knowing full well that Favre was going to come to New York. We were all like, at that time, well, it's Deadspin. Who cares? So we were all, and I guess this is an indictment of us in the local media, ready to just be like, whatever, this Jen Sturger, we don't know who she is. The Yankees are in town. Tom's right. The tabloids, the Post and Daily News come out, and they start to question him. And then we're like, well, we can't ignore this now. And that was a whole nother thing. And then I found out in retrospect off that one, that Brett was sort of persona non grata at home for a while after that. So if nothing else, all hell's breaking loose on his home front because he had that place in Eden Prairie right near the practice facility.
Mm-hmm.
But the, back to the Moss thing. So the Moss thing was he plays three games or four games? I think it might have been four.
Four. I think it was four.
Okay, gets to the fourth game.
But so they lose to the Jets. They lose that game to the Jets in New York. It's like 1 a.m. Favre's doing the press conference where he's gesturing with his wedding ring hand to just nonstop questions about the Deadspin stuff and the pictures and all that stuff. Following week, they beat the Cowboys. So you're thinking, all right, this is now the point in the season where it's going to go one way or the other. 2-3, still got everything ahead of them, whole bunch of division games, haven't played the Packers yet. They go to Lambeau and lose that game. It's a close game.
Mm-hmm.
If I remember,
Moss alligator arms a ball in the back of the end zone, which is where
gave him a chance in that game.
There was also
what I mean when Favre, he's trying to flip the switch still.
Vasante Shenko caught a pass that probably would have been ruled a touchdown today based on trapped the ball in the end zone.
And Childress in the press conference after the game goes, 50 drunks in a bar. All 50 are going to say that's a catch.
That's a catch, yeah.
And in fact, I believe that Childress got fined the next day because he came out and said the league called him and apologized. Mm-hmm. The league said we were wrong. But the play of that game that I will always remember is Moss alligator arm the ball in the back of the end zone. And at that point you said, he's not worth this, is he? See, that was the key. Because the day of the press conference, he came back. We all assumed it's Randy. Randy's back, right? Well, you're watching this shell of a player. And he's like, arm up, arm down, whoa. And as far as physical attributes go, now we're onto a path where this guy's too big a pain in the ass to be worth what. Because what made Randy so great was Randy was a pain in the butt from day one.
Yeah, but talent to baggage ratio.
Exactly.
Talent to baggage ratio never fails.
So now we got a problem.
Mm-hmm. So now we're three games into the Moss era. They just lost to the Packers, which is everything to Favre, where he had played his ass off. He comes back, and I just had to Google this to make sure I'm remembering the timeline correctly. Favre shows up at his press conference the following Wednesday in a walking boot, like up to his knee.
Yes.
He's like hobbling to the podium. You're going, there's no way this guy's going to play. Like this is it. They got the Patriots that week. It's the big game for Moss.
The streak's
Moss
not done.
Is not talking to the media. He gets fined that week because Judd turned him into the NFL.
I also got the Boston Herald sent a reporter to Minneapolis. Moss is talking to her. So I go over and I'm like, so we're talking. He shuts it down.
Did you say that out loud?
She confronts me walking out of the locker room and says, since when do you break up one-on-ones? And I said, since I'm trying to get this guy fined for not talking to the local media. In essence, I don't care about you and your Boston attitude.
Wow, look at you picking fights.
Take that.
She also, that week, scared off Favre, who had established a weekly routine. He would talk to everybody on the beat on like Thursdays at his locker.
I forgot about
BS
that.
And like actually tell us stuff about the game, how he was feeling and stuff like that. She like makes a beeline for him, like is trying to like ask him, so are you playing? And he like looks at her and just goes into the training room. We never saw him again, never did it again. So by Friday, he's out of the boot and claiming he might play.
Am I going to play? Maybe.
Oh, it gets better. It keeps going. Seriously, there's things I didn't remember that I'm remembering now.
So he starts the game against the Patriots. And then sometime, I don't remember exactly when it was, he takes a hit up under his like his chin area. He's bleeding profusely. The press box in Foxborough is in one of the end zones. And he's getting taken out on a cart, flat on his back, with like a towel being held to his chin and being driven to the locker room. This is the most durable quarterback in NFL history. He still had missed a start at that point. The start streak was live, 270-odd games, whatever it was. And we're watching him, like, just getting, like, beat up. It's just like, you know, the heavyweight boxer at the end. It's just like, this is not okay now.
Do you remember it turned out, as I recall, he was legitimately afraid of blood. So he's bleeding, and he's like, oh, my God, I'm bleeding. He must not have bled much during his life.
Yeah.
Because he was legitimately said, I was afraid of blood. And so he freaked out. Because he was bleeding, we're like a hockey player. If that had been a hockey puck, they would have been like, stitch me up, I'll go back out.
Yeah, so like my teeth.
He freaked out.
So that day, the Patriots game plan, which they've used on other receivers, but basically they had a corner on Moss, and then they played a safety over the top.
Yes.
The whole game. Just basically they wanted to turn Randy into a ticking time bomb so he would explode and just ruin everything. Just double team him. Let anyone else beat you, not Moss.
But the interesting thing about that was Belichick ordinarily would do that to really good receivers. Randy had to, by this point, the Green Bay thing to me spoke volumes about the fact that he wasn't the same player. So Belichick almost did it to just bleep with him. Like, instead of being
No, he wanted to make him explode.
Yeah.
He wanted to cause a problem that would just ruin everything, like, on the Vikings sideline. Mm-hmm. Moss had one catch for 8 yards in that game. He goes to the podium in Foxborough.
Oh, wait. No. So, the story is...
Right, what happened before, which you've reported.
So Scoggins, so I'm in the meet... the media room for the visitors, which is supposed to be Brad and Brett probably. And Chip, who was on the beat with me at the Star Tribune, is in the locker room. So the guys who are in the locker room are all in front of Moss's locker. Sometimes he would talk, sometimes he wouldn't. But if he was going to talk, you had to be there.
Oh, that's right. No, yeah.
And
yeah.
So Randy gets to his
thought you were, hold on. What he did on the way into the locker room is what I thought you were going to say.
Oh, I'll explain that too. No. That's another story.
There's so many things in this one day that happened.
Do you want me to tell you this? What Scoggins saw?
Just do it chronologically. I was there in the same part. Do it chronologically. Okay.
This is football cocaine right now.
I will debunk.
He's walking to the locker room.
Bless Gus Tanucci. But that whole story is the biggest bunch of BS ever. Number one, it did happen.
That's right. That was also that week.
That week.
By the way, 1500 ESPN.
It was the Friday.
We got an amazing live broadcast out of that at Tanucci's where people turned in their Moss jerseys at the front door to get like discounted.
Okay, so now we've rewound to Friday the week. So here's the timeline, just in case we've now lost you because we're going off the top of our heads. Wednesday, Favre in boot. Thursday to Friday. I believe it was Thursday. Moss gets fined $25,000 for not talking to the media,
which he was supposed to.
Friday, Favre out of boot.
Okay.
Locker room doors open.
Okay, Friday, no general media access to any player at the podium. So most relaxed day of the week. It's a great day. If you're a beat guy, it's a great day because you're done with most stuff and you can actually have casual conversations. But before you get into that locker room, they, at that time, to be clear, it's Winter Park, so this is the prehistoric days, feed the players in the locker room. So,
like a buffet set up in front of a bunch of the lockers.
Catered by different people that they would bring in. Tanucci sometimes, Popeye sometimes.
And if they got hot, they wouldn't change the caterer.
Yes, and
they'd
if they
serve
lost,
the same thing.
The caterer was out. So this Friday before the Patriots game, it's Tanucci's. So they get into the locker room and guys are excited and they get their plate of food and go to their locker and they eat and then we come in. But right before we come in, Randy walks in and sees the Tanucci's and says, and that's the famous line where he looks at the spread and says, I wouldn't feed this stuff to my dog, which is probably partially in his mind accurate because I think he did love his dog. Because to go back, I'm going to go back way back from then. That was the whole, my former Star Tribune colleague Kent Youngblood, one day when he was on the Viking beat way before I was, saw Randy playing with his dog at Winter Park. And said, Randy, that's really awesome. What's the name of your dog? And Randy said to Kent, Nunya. And Kent said, I'm sorry, Randy, what? And he said, it's none of your business.
Yeah, Nunya.
So he probably did have a dog he loved very much. And he decided on that Friday that he wouldn't have fed Nunya that food.
Sure. So we saw the tail end of that. Because the locker room door is open and Randy's just like yelling about the caterer and all this stuff. But like what you have to understand, because Mike Silver, my current colleague, is the one who wrote that story after the fact. And what you had to understand was like it didn't stick out because Randy was just doing that stuff every day. Every day you'd walk in and he's yelling some stuff. And it was just like it didn't even register. That's not why the guy got cut. It's because now, okay, so from Friday to Saturday to Sunday, he walks into the locker room and says to the owners.
Okay, so the whole thing with the Wilfs is the Wilfs always bring some of their friends into the locker room. At the end of games, they're standing where the players come in. You know, come watch the players. So this is the whole thing, as Tom said. He's caught one pass for 8 yards. Belichick has schooled Brad. It's been a complete joke.
For the second time in 5 years.
And so, Randy and, I kid you not, Fahu Tahi are the first two into the locker room off the field. And Randy looks at Ziggy and all of these people, Ziggy's friends, right? So these are his buddies. And Randy says, y'all better get yourself a new bleeping coach because this one can't bleeping coach at all. And that gets back to Brad. And that's the first thing. And the Wilfs, of course, Ziggy, I don't know how impressionable he is now, but in 2010, he was very impressionable. And this is, oh my God, I can't believe I just heard that. And more importantly, somebody immediately tells Brad that. And now we get to the locker room.
So Moss goes to the locker room, or to his locker in Foxborough, which is like, if I remember correctly, because I was standing right there. It was me, Chip, there were a couple other people. And it's like he's in toward a corner of like the relatively cramped locker space at Gillette Stadium. And he's like getting changed. And he says like, you know, something along the lines of like, y'all, you know, wanted to stand there and watch a bunch of grown men get dressed. It's like, okay, you know, whatever. And then Tom West, longtime Vikings PR guy, is standing there too, and he was kind of Randy's guy. And Randy goes, Tom, I'm going to the podium. And West is one of the great poker faces of all time, but you could just see, like, his eyes just go kind of,
Yeah. Look, I got fined $25,000 for not talking to you all, and me personally, I really don't care, but at the same time, answer questions throughout the week. But for the league to fine me $25,000, I'm not going to answer any more questions for the rest of this year. If it's going to be an interview, I'm going to conduct it. So I'll answer my own questions, ask myself the questions, then give y'all the answers. So from here on out, I'm not answering any more questions for the rest of this season. And enough said of that. Now we get to the game. I know how hard these guys work here in New England. And the only thing that I really tried to do is take what the best coach in football history has brought upon me, or the knowledge that he's given me about the game of football. And I tried to just sprinkle it off, you know, to the guys the best way I know how. So, you know, I'm going to go ahead and end this interview. You know, I have my family to see. Definitely down that we lost this game, because I didn't really expect for us to lose this game, knowing that, you know, we had a few things that we had to clean up. But like I said, they played a good game. I wish we could have had that three at the end of the half. Maybe it could have been different. Maybe not. But, you know, with – I don't know how many more times I'm going to be up here in New England, but I'm going to leave the New England Patriots, Coach Belichick, man, with a salute, man. I love you guys. I miss you. I'm out.
And the last thing you see, Moss walks off. Judd from his front row seat pops up, steps in to grab his recorder off the podium, turns back to the room and goes, "This is awesome."
That was the last
Judd's crowning moment.
The next day, I believe Mike Lombardi, who was working for NFL Network at the time, breaks the news they've cut Moss.
Let's back up, though.
Yeah.
So the press conference the next day. Okay. So we're in Winter Park. Brad comes to the podium. He has cut Moss. We don't know it. Nobody in that room knows it.
Don't know it.
So Brad goes on and on about Randy, and it got very cryptic. And to his credit,
he didn't fly back with the team. He stayed behind with family.
And to his credit, a guy who, as a beat guy, was fantastic. Bob Sansevier. Ages ago, but he was fantastic. Bob finally looks at Brad and says, "Did you cut him?" Like, he had the sense, which is a hell of a sense to have. I give Bob a lot of credit. And he's like, "No, we haven't cut him, blah, blah, blah." And so we're all like, okay, this is really weird. But Bob was the one who sensed that something had gone off the tracks, off the rails. And I remember getting back to the press room, and I got a call. It might have been from NFL Network or somebody, and they said Michael Lombardi is reporting he's been cut. And
you tweeted it, I remember.
And so we then have locker room access, but it's a Monday, so no one's going to be in the locker room, except for poor Ben Lieber, who was putting at NFL PA flyers on his teammates. So Ben's a good guy. We got him, and we're like, "What happened?" And he's like, or we said, "Has he been cut?" And he said, "Yeah, he's been cut." But what's most hysterical about that whole thing is Ben Lieber got reamed by Childress for acknowledging what Brad lied about.
Yeah, what's the advantage of lying in that spot if you're Brad Childress?
Because he hadn't told ownership.
Right.
That he couldn't. But for Ben to ream Ben out was the most ridiculous thing of all time.
I just remember Ben as locker just, he was answering for everybody. Because of the timing of it, it broke right after Childress's press conference.
Yeah.
I mean,
actually, here's why I want to reset this with another key question here. If we take away the 2010 season, which I know is a huge if elephant in the room, we can't just take it away. But if we took away the 2010 season and we just evaluated Brad Childress as a head coach based on his four full years between 2006 and 2009, we're talking about a 36-28 record, two division wins, a trip to the NFC Championship game. What would the prevailing thought have been if Brad Childress did not coach the 2010 season? If we wiped it away, what would the thought have been about? Because I think right now, you pull Vikings fans and Brad Childress's name, scoffing at a minimum, I think, among Vikings fans. he's just become kind of a punchline. What if you take away the 2010 season?
Oh, okay, this is a layered question, though, because it's not as simple, well, he would have been a great coach or he would have been a terrible coach. Part of it depended on, because I covered Brad for that entire time period, and part of it would have depended on the time period. I felt Brad wasn't very comfortable as a coach when he got here. I thought he developed into a guy who became a better coach. But I guess, Phil, where I sort of get stuck on that question, too, is the most important game of Brad's career, which was the 2009 conference title game, because the conference title game became such a mess because in some ways you outplayed the Saints so badly.
In almost every way.
Well, the statistically, I've always said that for me, in my time covering sports, if you take that game book and don't show me the final score and just plop the game book in front of me, I'd be like, oh, the Vikings won by 15 points.
Yeah.
But I know for a fact, people I've talked to, that the Vikings sort of lost control. Brad lost control of the sideline. You know, how do you have 12 men in the huddle? It's damn near impossible. And yet they achieved it. Coming out of a timeout. So I think, I don't know that I have a great answer for your question other than the Brad Childress's time, if you take away 2010, is still very complicated because I, you know, and after the fact, I've been told, and I believe this, that Brad was a really good evaluator of talent.
Yes.
That he did a hell of a job evaluating talent. So, you know, to scoff at him and be like, he wasn't a good coach. No, that's not true. But then again, when it was most important to have calm against the Saints in the Superdome, chaotic scene, but you got Favre at quarterback, all hell broke loose. So, Tom, I'm not sure what your response would be, but mine is, it's a very complicated scenario, and I don't think that you would scoff or laugh at Brad at all. Brad brought a lot of things. His ability to evaluate his roster was really good. And keep in mind, too, you know, they passed from the unfortunate hiring of Fran Foley to Rick Spielman, but Rick was Brad was the de facto GM.
Brad had the hammer.
Yeah. So this was not well, Rick and Brad. This was Rick helped. Brad ran that team and did some really good things.
Rick didn't have really full control till 2012.
Correct. But my point with Brad is I don't think it's a simple answer, and it's certainly not one that would lead me to scoff at Brad, but it's also not one that would say it was completely successful because that 2009 team, let's be honest, should have been in Miami playing in that Super Bowl.
Well, I mean, if you ask people, too, the story of what happened in 12 Men in the Huddle, since everybody's talking about that, what really happened was you had two assistant coaches who were responsible for getting the correct personnel on the field who were, from what I've been told, busy celebrating the imminent win. And
but didn't you hear, too, that Brad, I was told from that game when it got to crunch time that Brad was basically bellowing orders and nobody really had control, which became a problem too.
All I know was there are, you know, they had multiple versions of that personnel, whether they were in the Tiger personnel, the two tights, where they had the fullback on the field, and the two assistant coaches who were responsible for communicating that those personnel groups were like high-fiving each other and hugging each other on the sideline and didn't realize it. So Brad, who I think a lot of, I mean, you know, just knowing him personally, and I've gotten to know him even more over the, you know, in recent years, you know, and he won a lot of games. I mean, you can certainly look at, you know, the Travaris Jackson pick, which was, that was 2006. You draft a quarterback out of Alabama A&M, what was it?
Last pick of the second round, too.
Right. I mean, it was a high pick, and that was the guy, and going through, you know, Brooks Bollinger and everybody else that they started in those early days. But you know, they won a lot of games. They got better from year to year. And I had one of Brad's, assistants on the 09 team, you know, 09 and 10 team, tell me later, Brad didn't get fired because of football. Great evaluator, great coach. He got fired because he changed personally. Because he would go 0-60 on people because there was a...
That's an interesting point, too, because when Brad... Okay, so Brad got hired... So Tice, the perception of Tice in 2005 was, Mike Tice is allowing the media in the building. They're walking around the building. They're doing what they want. Brad gets hired. and he's Andy's guy in Philadelphia, but he's the offensive coordinator who doesn't call plays. So Brad gets hired, and Brad decides to crack down. So he's going to be Belichick. I remember talking to Tice after 2005, and he's telling me about his assistants being fired, just because it's a good story for me for the Star Tribune. So I had Brad's cell phone, so I called Brad in Philadelphia, who's flown back home, and Brad's like, "You're calling me at home or something?" I said, "Yeah, I have to. You're firing people." And he's like, "We'll take care of this when I get back." And I'm in the media. I don't care, Brad. So this is the Brad who's going to be Belichick. He's going to be a hard ass. I was told that after 2006, and don't forget, I believe in 2006, Pat Williams, who was a favorite of players, is put on the pup because he's overweight, and God bless him for that. He's a big guy that shows up fat. Okay, big deal. Brad puts him on the pup. He's going to discipline Pat. Players are like, "What are you doing?" Players hated it. I was told during the 2006 to 2007 offseason, Phil, that Brad hung out with Dungy. Seriously, hung out with Dungy. Dungy's like, "Oh, no, here's what you should do." So 2007, I remember training camp. All of a sudden, Brad's like running drills with players. It's great fun. He's going to be Dungy. And that guy, I thought, lasted through 2009. And players could tolerate that. They didn't mind that. And it worked. And then 2010 takes a hard turn back to, "I'm going to be a hard ass again." So I don't think Brad could evaluate talent. I think he really knew football. I don't think he ever knew, to what Tom's saying, who he wanted to be. And for a head coach, that's a problem. Andy Reid knows exactly who Andy Reid is, right? Like, you never look at Reid and be like, "I think he's confused." Belichick. You never look at Belichick
unless
and be
like, "Unless it's the two-minute drill," but that's the easy punchline there.
But as far as who he is as a human, Belichick. You don't look at him and be like, "I think Bill's a little bit mixed up today about who he is." And so I think that's where Brad...
Same with Steve Belichick, by the way.
Oh, Steve Belichick's the greatest. But I think that's...
Steve's a character now. I've taught Steve at, you know, Super Bowl days and stuff. Did you? Like that. At, 2 years ago when they were here. And I was mostly covering the Eagles that year. But, like, I would still show up to the Patriots availabilities because, like, Josh McDaniels was about to be... potentially the Colts head coach.
Oh, that's right.
Again, you know, there were a lot of storylines. And like one day, and so at Super Bowl media days, they're so massive. And like everybody sees media night, right, which is now Monday night. It used to be media day. Now it's Monday night. Well, there's still more availabilities. Tuesday, there's like a podium thing with like 10 guys. Wednesday, Thursday, it's everyone in the organization. They're all there. And the media has kind of lost interest at that point. So you've just got people sitting there alone. And so one day it was Steve Belichick. I'm just like, you know, looking around, I'm like, "Oh, Steve's sitting there." So I just like went over there and talked to him about Bill for 10 minutes. And he was, you know, really interesting. I mean, he's his dad. He's different, you know, a little different guy, but like there's a lot of the same thing. But yeah, he's an interesting character. Yeah. So that was the same Super Bowl week where Alshon Jeffrey more or less guaranteed a Super Bowl win while I was sitting there.
Was that the one here?
With one other guy, and I was just like...
Was that the one here?
Yeah.
When Mackie and I were on Radio Row that whole week, and we saw Alex Smith, and we were trying to sell the Vikings, but then he got traded during that week?
Yeah, that was not a great
to the
night.
Chiefs?
Kirk Cousins in line at the...
Steak Shack?
Steak Shack.
Yeah.
That was an entertaining week.
Did you guys see the fight that year?
Wow. Now that we've deviated on
Row?
This, okay.
Yeah.
We were at the table next to where it started.
See it. We were the ringside commentators.
It was Josh Innes going over to, was it 6:10?
Seth Payne, right?
It's Seth Payne, yep. Yes. And Mike Meltzer. And so we're sitting there prepping for our show.
Josh was literally right by us and walked by us.
Yeah.
He had to walk by us to get to it.
Josh Innes, who, by the way, is famous for spend a year and a half in a market, go full WWE, WCW on a market, and flame out and go find
another
job.
Don't be surprised if he's at Score North soon.
In fact, yeah. Josh, call me. No.
No, seriously.
Final key question for you guys. And it was originally going to be something about the Metrodome roof collapsing, but
we're not even to November yet.
No, this is crazy.
We're wrapping this up.
Where should we be going?
So here's my...
I just want to say, the week after, you still haven't said the story. The week after the Patriots game, they cut Moss... And then on that Friday, Percy.
Oh, God, the whole barbell thing. Okay. All right, so if we have time.
Audible. No, let's do it.
If we have it. Red 80, Blue Tiger. So on that next week, so as Tom said earlier in tonight's podcast or today's podcast,
we've been here a while.
We've been here a while. Yes.
We haven't slept in 40 hours. Just telling 2010 Viking stories.
So Percy had helped Randy pack up.
Right.
Like went to Randy's place. The only guy, but they, now they're thick as thieves. So Percy's all in on Randy. And, you know, you really can't blame him. Because Randy, although his skills had declined, was a hero. So now we get to the barbell incident. And it is a situation where Brad and Percy, what, he kicked him out of practice?
He was. He was dogging it in practice. And Percy, that was the year that Percy just had a bunch of, you know, we talked. We, like, glossed over the whole got taken away in an ambulance thing, but there were always different injury issues, migraine issues, whatever. You didn't know if he was actually going to show up, you know, on a Wednesday or whatever. But that day in practice, and one game, I don't remember which one it was, but Percy was running pregame laps, like dragging his leg behind him. And I tweeted something like, Percy looks like he's, you know, he doesn't look like a guy who can play today. And then Percy went out and had like 200 yards at a ridiculous game. And I just got torched by fantasy football morons. And, you know, rightfully so in that particular case. But Brad, that day at practice, was like, you're slacking, like you're dogging it here. Threw him out of practice for like basically playing up his injury. And we were watching, like he was every day he was going out there and it was really like this shuffle. You know, but he accused him of dogging it.
And he didn't want to practice. And so Brad wouldn't just accept that. So anyway, he kicks him out of practice. They get in a confrontation post-practice. And this is...
And the weight room is directly at this time at Winter Park connected attached. To the field house.
Okay, so it's a cheap weight room.
The shed, but yeah.
Yeah, it's a shed. There's a cheap weight room. It's the shed. There's a door. So Brad and Percy get in a shouting match. And this is, you know, and keep in mind, too, this now goes back to training camp with Brad... hounding Percy, are you coming back to practice? Percy being like, bleep off, I'm not coming back, blah, blah, blah. So at some point in time in this weight room, Percy picks up a weight and he, you know, strong enough to, takes the weight and throws it at Brad. And at the last second, somebody closes the door and it hits the door, not Brad, thank God. And so now, and the problem by now is he's cut Moss. So like he can't keep suspending or cutting players. You're now at your wit's end. And in the big picture of things, it's a small thing, but it just goes on to adding on to, and I think Tom would agree with me on this. Now you're adding on to, my God, this has gone from could it be a gong show to it's a gong show to it's now crossed something where I'm not sure about you. I've never come close since. I mean, I never came close before. There was, now we know, and we know everything. Like, everything's gotten out, which in football, I don't think it necessarily does.
Well, and I think that was a credit to you in particular, Judd, and not to turn this into, you know, love time here, but you and Chip were doing an excellent job of being able to report the blow-by-blow. I was in the first year on the beat. I was trying to do my part, but... I mean, a lot of stuff did come out, and it was on, like, a weekly basis. Like, when that Percy thing happened, you guys had it that night, on that Friday night, which was not great because we were not working together. So then I had to deal with that. But it was just, there was so much going on. And so, and Phil, I've already forgotten what your last question is going to be, so stop me if I'm going to step on it.
I'll fire it out in a second.
But, and I'm looking at the Viking schedule right here and cheating a bit, but... So somehow they win that game with Percy, I think, inactive after the thing with Childress. Then they lose to the Bears the following week in Chicago. And then it's the final Favre-Packers game.
And the Vikings-Cardinals game, I remember being on the sideline for that game after the Percy thing in the Metrodome, because that's back in the day where they didn't care if you went down the sideline.
And pregame.
Pregame. And I remember,
I remember
looking at Longwell and the long snapper, Clem Loeffler, and I'm like... So just another week in paradise, boys, and they're laughing. Like, everybody knows. Everybody's in on the joke by this point. Longwell's like, yeah, what are you going to do? And so, like, this has crossed. At this point now, we've crossed a threshold.
Right.
I don't think you'll cross it again. I certainly know I won't. Now you're at a point where I was what? That was, so that's 2010. I was 40-ish. But I mean, now it's comical. Now it's people are laughing. Players are laughing with you. Think about that for a second. And we're all in this and saying, oh my God. But I remember being on the sideline that I remember that game, because the Vikings come back and win that game. And literally the players are like, what are you going to do? And so now you've gone from NFC Championship game in that January, really right. good team, to whoa.
And even going into that, the last Packers game, at that point, the Vikings are 3-6, right? That is the last gasp, and it's, we've seen Favre play to an unbelievable degree. The two games in 09. You talk about the Lambeau game. I remember the Metrodome game, which was like week five or so. It was Monday Night Football.
Day before 163.
Mm-hmm. And that's the loudest I've ever heard a stadium. Louder than the Superdome, which is the loudest stadium that I've ever been in just on a regular basis. And then watching the... And Doug the dog has now walked in. And you hear a chain.
Let Dog...
Doug, get Dougie. Out of there!
I'll let Dougie run around. Come on. Come on, Dougie. Come here. Come here, boy.
So, and I remember watching the... You know, the TV copy after that game, and it looked like, you know, the Coliseum. I mean, the purple jerseys behind Favre, and he's celebrating. It was just cool to watch. And then 2010, the first game at Lambeau, he's still doing everything he can, and they lose. And you just feel like, how much does he have left? And then that game at the Metrodome, not that that was all on Favre, but it was a disaster. It was 31-3.
Oh, yeah.
And
well, and just quickly, if Childress loses the Cardinals game, he's fired then.
Right.
So his fate is sealed.
Right. So he buys himself time. They lose to Chicago. Then they go into the Packers game. They're non-competitive. And I remember watching the tape back at my old apartment in Minneapolis and realizing the next day, because I always did those extensive film reviews for 1500, and on like the, I believe it was the next to last play and counting, because I'd always chart who's on the field and realizing the next to last play in that game, the Vikings had 10 men on the field on offense. I'm not sure there's any other occasion that has happened in recent NFL history. And I had to watch it 5-6 times, because Favre at that point has to look around, realize there's not enough people, and say, screw it. And he basically dropped, took a 7-step drop, and threw the ball 50 yards out of bounds. And I remember I included that the next day, and like I was getting texts from people being like, are you sure? I'm like, 100%, 10 guys on the field. And that just showed, you know, everyone knew it was over, including Brett. So then the you know, kind of the soliloquy to that and what set the stage for the next 3 years was they fire Brad the next day. They install Leslie Frazier, who everybody, I think, in the organization, particularly ownership, believed should get another chance, or should get a chance to be a head coach, rather, at that time. He was kind of the coach in waiting if they ever made a move. And they win. They beat the Redskins.
Yep.
They beat the Bills.
That was McNabb's Redskins.
You know, they lose to the... That's right. Before they acquired McNabb the following year.
Which Leslie pushed for. Which Leslie had to have.
Which was...
That's another... That's another podcast.
Saw him come out and vomit on his way onto the practice field, which is rarity.
Hey, Burger King, I'm coming.
I think his first press conference was listening.
Taco Bell, we're coming.
Fast food place.
Oh, man. That was a press conference for the ages.
But anyway, yes, you're correct.
But then they have the game where the roof collapses on the morning of.
Can we go back to that one for a second? Can we stop there? So, all right. So, they play the Bills. Tom's got the schedule.
The game's supposed to be December 12th.
Okay, so December 11th.
At the Metrodome.
So December 11th, I go to, Don and I drive through the snowstorm and go to the Gopher basketball's playing somebody crappy. But, you know, it's Williams. So we go, and it's obviously a huge snowstorm. And so that night I'm texting with somebody, and they're like, we're hearing there's water gushing in the Metrodome. And I was like, well, I checked with somebody. They said, oh, I checked with the team. I think it was Lester Bagley. He's like, yeah, there's a leak. It's fine. And I checked with a source, and they're like, oh, no, we hear the roof is gushing. So I'm like, okay, who am I going to believe? And, you know, I'm a Vikings reporter. I'm not a roof reporter. I don't really care. Because you're never assuming the roof's going to collapse.
You're not thinking the worst-case scenario is and game canceled.
I remember I went to bed that night, and I woke up at, you know, 6:30, 7 the next Sunday, and I've got a text from Seifert from, like, 4:58 a.m. It collapsed. And I'm like, what? And he's like, yeah, the roof collapsed. It's amazing. Down. And so okay, so this is where, for me, it all jumped the shark. So now we've gone from, this seems odd, to, it could be a gong show, to, it is a gong show, but it's an amusing gong show, you know, the Moss thing. I love the Moss thing. It was great. To, oh my God, what's going on here? Why am I being tortured? And so I remember thinking to myself, what should I do? Like, do I go down there and check out the Metrodome? And at this point, I'm still at the Star Tribune. The Star Tribune's right across the street from the Metrodome. And, or do I stay here? Or, because they're not playing. Right. Oh, and the Giants, who they're supposed to play, had been diverted to Kansas City and told just stay in Kansas City because we can't get you to Minneapolis. So there's going to be no game. So I'm like, I tell Dawn, my wife, I said, let's just drive me down there. So I remember I went down to the paper, and I'm working at the paper, and then they're like, there's going to be access at the Metrodome. They're going to show you. You can walk into the press box and see. And I remember walking in, and it's a war zone. Like, the roof is on the field. The field is full of snow.
That would have, by the way, if that had happened a few hours later when people are on the field and bustling. I mean,
well, you've
that,
seen
that
a,
kills
could have
somebody.
Been slightly problematic.
You've seen, yeah, the clip, right, of
the
poor
guy driving
on the Cushman.
The car. Yeah.
The Cushman. He's getting
right,
the Cushman.
It was the Fox camera that they had set up.
And the Fox guy, and yeah, God bless him, he was the one who had the foresight to leave the camera on. He's like, I'm going home, but I can see it's geysering through the roof. He's the one who saw it coming down. So anyway, I went in there and looked at it, and I remember I'm in the press box, and we're getting quotes from, I think, the sports commission. And Chip calls. He's like, they're going to Detroit. And I'm like, what? He's like, we're playing in Detroit on Monday night. We got to go. And so I remember sitting in the airport Sunday night with Chip. Well, actually, Dawn picked me back up from downtown. And that's when I got in her car. And my story, personally, my best story of that year was, I looked around and I said, it's too much now. Like, I can't do this anymore. It's become, this is like taxing, this is costing me years. And I remember she drove me out to the airport, and I'm sitting there with Chip in the airport eating dinner. And we looked at each other and we're like, we're really, and by the way, this was, they hadn't played the Lions yet. So they were going back to Detroit.
Right.
And I remember looking at Chip, and we're both like, this is now unbelievable. Like, just from a personal standpoint.
Right.
Forget the team.
I remember checking into a hotel that night right by, you know, in Romulus, Michigan.
We probably
right, by,
right
the,
by you.
Right by the hotel. Yeah. And going to, like, some terrible bar to, like, try to eat something. And, like, having a 30-second conversation with myself going, what city am I in?
Yeah.
Where am I? Because I was driving to the studio to do the Sunday morning show with Suhan. Because I used to, at 1500, we'd do the show. We'd tape the last hour, the last half hour, and then I would beeline it to the stadium and get there right before kickoff that year. And, you know, and yeah, the roof, you know, the roof had collapsed. We end up in Detroit. The following week is that game's moved to TCF, which is when Favre was ruled out, and then upgraded questionable on game day, which the Bears the following and then started, which
you?
The Bears the following year pulled the greatest, like, no FU move of all time, listed like three guys, including Charles Tillman, as doubtful, and they all suited up as a payback.
That's amazing.
Can I tell you, though, my favorite part about the Detroit game against the Giants? So it's the Giants and Vikings in Detroit in Ford Field. And God bless Detroit. It's godforsaken. Like, it's Detroit. So they literally come out and announce anybody who wants to go can go for free.
Oh, that's right.
Okay. So we are standing, and I think I was with you, Tommy, on the field.
Yeah.
Because the Vikings, okay, the Lions don't let you on the field before games if you're just a, a media credentialed person, but the Vikings did at the time. So the Vikings are like, well, these are our rules. So
this was basically going to be an empty stadium anyway.
Yeah.
There was no rules.
And it was like a Vikings home game. So they had announced, if you want to come to the game, come to the game. Well, you know, Detroit, it's got some rough spots, got some rough people. Literally, the first thing I see, the doors open, and we're standing on the field, and we're looking up in the stands, is a guy. Well, take it from here. You saw it.
There were just hundreds of people but running.
The first thing I saw was a guy run into the stadium, hit a seat, and fly. And the first thing I see is a man. And, I mean, it's not even funny, but it was just emblematic of that season. He's literally flying headfirst into the next seat. And again, you're like, what?
It was just total and complete chaos. People sprinting in. You know, I remember it was you or Chip who said it, but like, they're going to be finding people hiding in closets
a
month after
I
this.
I said the poor homeless. I mean, I don't mean to be flipping here, but it's Detroit. They're going to be hiding below seats forever here.
I don't remember if they painted the logos on the field, but they definitely had all the Vikings.
Oh no, they did.
Graphics.
No, they painted the Viking logo on the field,
just to make it feel a little bit more cozy for the Vikings.
They're doing the skull. Yeah, vroom, they were doing the horn and the whole thing.
And this is before the skull chant,
right? So this is just horn. It was bizarre.
How many Vikings fans made the trek for that game?
A couple hundred.
None. I don't know.
They chartered like two planes and people came. So, I mean, they lose that game. Following week is the Favre out, questionable, starts game. Corey Wooten hits him, and he goes down in like the chalk outline pose and is down on the field for 30 seconds.
But you got to tell.
Out.
But so the only reason why that game. So they tried to move that game to Atlanta, which I think they were going to. But the issue was that was 50 years of Vikings football. So they're going to have a huge celebration, and this was way pre-planned, at the convention center. So the Vikings decide, come hell or high water, we're going to play this game at TCF Bank Stadium. They don't have, as you said, Phil, they don't have heating coils in the field yet. And so that's the one where Cluey tweets, hey, you guys did a great job, great effort. Someone's going to die if you do this. So I remember showing up to the convention center and the Vikings PR guy, Bob Hagen, who I, great guy, love him dearly, pulls me aside. He's like, that's just a punter. Don't listen to him. I'm like, okay, whatever. You know, I'm covering the team. So, and I'm going to suspend my belief. I don't care. Like, let's just get through this. And so the Vikings do the honor and the ceremony's awesome. But who knew the guy who almost would die would be Brett Favre. Man.
He went down hard.
And McKinney whiffed.
Corey Wooten comes off the offensive left edge.
McKinney whiffed him.
And just, he went down. It was chalk outline. One arm up, one arm down.
Yep.
Legs spread.
Out.
Down on the field. Out. That's before, I mean, that was the catalyst for the NFL not letting guys who have concussions do press conferences.
I've been told since
Brett did that press conference and was not with it.
So we were
after
all,
the game.
So we all showed up to the post game press conferences are like, okay, Brett's not coming in. They're like, oh, don't count on that. So Brett comes in and he is out on his feet, but yet he's Brett.
Hey, everybody.
So he could, but he's Brett. So everybody he starts.
Like Wrangler,
so he just starts talking.
Like you would never. This would never happen now.
But Tom's right. That was flat out the whole catalyst for the.
I think it was the next year they changed.
They did.
It.
They did, and I've since been told by a member of the Vikings PR department that was a big mistake. But Brett was, by that point, Brett's like, I'll just go and talk.
Man. Yep.
Amazing.
And then the following week is the Philly game that gets
on a Tuesday.
Delayed by a day or by 2 days because the mayor declares a state of emergency. Mayor Nutter declared a state of emergency.
This is a whole
for
podcast.
Like a half inch of snow because they thought it was going to be the blizzard
of
the century.
Wait, okay, so we get there. Hold on. It's going to be a.
We're staying at the Vikings Hotel downtown Philly.
Ritz Sheridan.
The Ritz.
Okay, so we
Ritz
get in
Carlton.
There. On, or Ritz Carlton. So we get there on a Saturday,
Judson
right?
Class.
Yeah. Okay. Hold on. Bleep you. So we get there on a Saturday, right?
Right.
So we're all there, and we're all like, okay, this is good. So they're like, there's going to be a snowstorm. We're like, and, you know, we're from Minnesota. We're like, whatever. It's going to be a snowstorm. Big deal. Mayor declares state of emergency. So that's the one where Scoggins is, calls me. He's like, we got to get out of here. We got to go stay out.
Then he calls me. I'm not even affiliated with you guys, and he still tells me the same thing. Tom, I got to get out. You know, I got caught in the city.
We were trying to take care of you. So we all go.
We got
to
go.
We got to go. So we all go stay out by the airport. And we're out by the airport. And
here's us from the Ritz-Carlton to a Renaissance, which generally is a nice hotel. That one was not.
And to be clear, the only reason why the NFL didn't play that game on a Monday was because they had played the Giants game on a Monday in Detroit and had been told unequivocally, you won't do that again because it was Monday Night Football, and then they regionalized the Giants-Vikings game.
Right, it wasn't a national TV game.
It wasn't. Yeah. So ESPN's like, you ain't doing that twice to us. So they're like, okay, Tuesday Night Football. So,
which is now called Maction, actually, on ESPN. Yeah. It's great.
So anyway, wait, but there's more, because tell the story about the Tuesday night game.
The which part?
The Tuesday night game itself. The Tuesday night game was...
Well, I was going to rewind to when we're at that terrible Renaissance. We're the only three... Like, it is a full-on post-apocalyptic, everyone else is dead, and it's only me, Judd, and Chip that are still alive. Like, no one else in the hotel... Remember getting in the hot tub and the whole hot tub shook at the hotel.
I was
like,
in the bar, you dummy. I didn't go to the. I didn't go.
Well,
to the
then there was that we were at the bar, and I know I've told this because you guys broke this out and put it on social, the story. But walking into a bathroom stall, and I still to this day want to know the backstory of why someone tried to flush their tighty whitey underwear, and they got caught in the back of the toilet.
Oh.
And just, like, your mind begins to spin at that point. But so we're there for, like, 3 days. Then the Tuesday game, Joe Webb is the starting quarterback. Fred Puggett dials up, you know, very good game plan. He had taken over when Leslie Frazier went to the head coaching job. Slot blitzes left and right.
From Antoine.
They were pressuring him. Joe Webb made a bunch of plays as going, hey, maybe Joe Webb could be the quarterback. And then basically you never saw Joe Webb at quarterback until the playoff game in Green Bay.
When he was great in the first series, but yeah.
When in the first series they ran zone read, and then the rest of the game tried to have him play quarterback, which didn't work out as well. But they won that game, and that was – so at that point now they're 3-2 since Leslie Frazier took over for Brad Childress, and that – spurred the Wilfs even before the finale in Detroit, back in Detroit against the actual team that plays there, to make Leslie Frazier the head coach, which then set the stage for the next 3 years.
And meanwhile, as Tom just said, Favre's consecutive game streak, which was legendary, had come to an end. And by that point, we were so exhausted that nobody really cared.
No one cared.
Seriously. Wow. By the time that came
it
to
ended,
an end.
It ended with the Giants game in Detroit.
Yes.
Because he did a press conference that day, too.
Yes.
And
we're in a stocking cap.
And it was. It was like 10 of us there, and just, it's over. And but he had been over it for a while.
I will say this. By the end of that year for Favre, there was, I'm not sure how Tom felt about this, I felt there was a definite sense of relief. Like, he was ready. I don't think he
ever
wanted to come back.
That's what I said in that press conference of everybody for, you know, and he pushed himself. I mean, that was part of what defined him, but... For however long it had been, 15 years, 16, 17 years, he had never missed a start. And that was the expectation. No matter what he was dealing with, he was going to be out there. That's a load off your shoulders once that's over.
The weird thing with Brett, too, was in covering him in 2003 and 2004 and then as a Viking, you know, he was always bound and determined to do his thing. But he was also very intent and not and this is not the wrong thing on the fact that he felt like he was going to feel. And I really think he felt coming back in 2010 was the wrong move. And in some weird way, I almost think how wrong it went justified how he had felt about it. Like, 2009 was such an accomplishment for him. And go look at his stats. That year is an MVP type of season. So in some ways, I think he came back. He felt forced to come back in 2010. He did it for other people. And I almost felt...
He was come back for the boys.
And I Absolutely. Almost felt he felt justified in this was the wrong move. And I knew it was the wrong move. Where 2009, if it had fallen apart, I think he would have been crestfallen. But it didn't fall apart. He was marvelous.
Yeah. But also some part of him, you know, call it ego, call it confidence, whatever. He believed when he came back they still had a chance. And it just became so apparent by week two.
Right.
This was not going to happen. Even week one, like, they didn't play well on offense, but it was like a 5-point game. Like, they were in it. Week two, when they lose to not a good Dolphins team, it was very apparent this isn't going to work out. That was what made that whole season go, was that you had these ebbs and flows from the week two, we're all done, to Randy Moss, to Childers fired, to, you know, the roof collapsed. I mean, there were just, I can't think of another season like it for any team.
And we definitely, in this town, I hope to God, never see that again, because it was...
Part of you kind of wants it.
No. You know what? It was too much for me. It was...
Judd's going to go...
That season created the Judd you see here.
Yeah.
It did.
I enjoy confusion and chaos, but that was too much.
Yeah.
There was too much at work there. And because the whole Favre storyline through 2009 and 10 was enough. Like, just Brett Favre himself. That was a great story, and it was really cool. But that went so off the rails and so wrong, and so many people were ultimately in some ways altered and or damaged by it.
Including Judd Zolgad.
Yeah, it was really bizarre.
Well, gentlemen, it's been my pleasure to throw the ball in the air and get out of the way for this entire show. This was amazing. And if you're listening and you're new to Minnesota Sports Rewind, we'd appreciate you subscribe on Apple or Spotify. Give us a 5-star review and leave a comment. Leave a comment of encouragement for Judd Zolgad, who is
about a
decade of therapy later here, removed from
and
the
And now it's all
season.
Come back to him. Yeah. Nightmares for days. Yep.
Thanks to Tom Pelissero from NFL Network, Judd Zolgad. I'm Phil Mackey from Score North. And again, this has been Minnesota Sports Rewind, available Apple, Spotify, or the Score North app. And we hope that you've either enjoyed or are now terrified for the rest of your life after listening to us blab about the 2010 disaster Vikings season.